Committee on Judiciary, Friday, May 30th, 1975, page 42, side 2. What bill are you here on?
2950.
Hold on, hon.
Chairman and members of the committee, this 2958 has been through the House Local Government Committee as well as the Committee on Ways and Means. Has been amended as far as the manner of financing is concerned, but basically the original concept remains in the bill, and that is the creation of a municipal bond advisory council. The reason we feel that it's necessary is the result of some work we did over the interim of an ad hoc committee checking the amount of sales, the various bond sales by local government units in the state over the past several years, and found that some of their sales, as a result of their practices, that based mainly on the lack of knowledge of how actually to issue bonds, resulted in their paying considerably more interest than they otherwise would have had to pay. We sell in Oregon, last year, $394 million in bonds. We feel that the sale of bonds can be done for considerably less in terms of interest rate if we simply provide the advice to the communities that are issuing these bonds on how to prepare their prospectus, what information is needed for the bond purchaser and the rating services, and this sort of thing. A committee would be made up of the treasurer, the attorney general, local governmental people, and citizens. It's really not a very complicated bill at all. The local governments that I've worked with in drafting the legislation are very enthusiastic about the concept. It's not a mandatory bill, other than it is mandatory from the standpoint of being a clearinghouse. In other words, the commission can't veto a bond issue or tell them that they can issue the bond, or they must do it in such a way, but it is mandatory so far as they have to let the commission know that they are going to issue bonds and then accept our advice or not is up to them.
Question to Mr. Reddy. The general feeling is that you can save the local community's money and selling them on.
Right, we think it's saving money. Really saved millions of dollars over the years. From the result, just in 1 year alone last year, in Oregon's issue, because they're AAA now rather than AA, the state saved, I think it's something in excess of $6 million over the life of those bonds, which is average 12 years. So it's just this. And we got our AAA rating simply because we gathered all of the information that the rating services needed and got it to the rating service.
Well, I assume you mean by selling at a saving would be at a lesser interest rate.
At a lesser interest rate.
Well, we had the bill last week, didn't we, that everybody was in such a panic about in order to raise the interest on the bond rate.
Right. That's raising, there's an overall limitation. That bill becomes law, would be 10%, but previously was 8% on almost all bond issues. You talk of saving on a bond, you're probably not even talking about a point between 7% or 8%, but somewhere in between a half a point, which of course represents a substantial savings. The problem is that a lot of these communities have a bond issue once every 10 or 12 years, and what we find they do is go back to the last issue and use those forms. The lawyer tells the secretary to copy this again, and they do it and find out that it's no longer valid or legal. One instance, we got a telephone call from a legal secretary on a bond issue with a question about how to proceed, and was unable to proceed because they're lost without fishing, and we were able to help in that instance. But it's a field that requires some expertise, and it's just not available, really, to some local communities, and they don't develop it because they don't issue frequently.
Jim, were we able to get the AAA rating because the facts more favored us this time, or because the facts really hadn't been communicated before?
That's right. They hadn't been communicated to the extent that the rating service itself was necessary. So we simply went back there and brought information and then put them on the mailing list from the Department of Economic Development and just kept working with them. Working on them.
It's a matter of doing the job more confidently then.
Well, it's doing it louder, I think.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Reddy. Did anybody else sign in that bill, John?
Thank you.
You want me to find myself?
That'll be my job. Bigger by me.
Copy job. We're going temporarily to House Bill 2165. However, we have other bills that we have to pass or make a decision on. And we will take as many people on 2165 as we can, but it will be interrupted, and then hopefully we will get back to it again. We will start now on 2165. George Ryan Miller.
Members of the city. My name is George Reinmiller. I'm the registered lobbyist for the Oregon Hearing Aid Society, supposed to have the hearing aid dealers here in Oregon. By way of a little historical background, as many of you know and remember, Oregon was the first state in the Union back in 1960 to introduce a bill regulating sales and dealings in hearing aids in the state of Oregon. Great tech worked hard on that bill. Norm Powers worked very hard on that bill. So Oregon's had regulations for about some 14 years, and in all fairness, the bill has worked quite well. This session, the hearing aid dealers themselves introduced Senate Bill 746, which has had some hearings with updates to law and put a few more teeth in it, but the bill has not gone very far. Last session of the Oregon legislature, a new entity was licensed in Oregon known as an audiologist. Some of you may have been not quite familiar with what an audiologist is. It's a hearing technician, a non-medical person that engages in hearing testing. The hearing aid dealers met with the audiologist many times during the course of the last session and did not oppose their bill. There was a hearing aid dealers bill pending last session, and there was kind of an agreement reached. They would not oppose ours, we would not oppose theirs. Their bill passed, ours, the last day, did not pass. And you might check with Great Tech and Norm Howard to see what happened on that. They felt the audiologists were strong in killing the hearing aid dealers bill. 2165 was introduced at the beginning of the session, and in its original form, supported by the audiologist, would have required a prescription from an audiologist before anyone could purchase a hearing aid in Oregon. That bill received flack from everyone, both of the Portland newspapers, the Oregonian and Journal, both came out editorially against the bill, called it claim jumping, and a brand new entity now jumping in and saying, we've just been licensed, now we're going to require that before anybody can buy a hearing aid, they have to be seen by an audiologist. Several consumer groups came out against it, and it didn't fly well. All along the road, we were talking about 746, the hearing aid dealers bill, people kept saying, well, you don't have to worry about it, because 2165 is pending in the House, and it takes care of everything. Quite frankly, it didn't take care of anything, and it had many, many hearings, a very rocky road. Finally, after a number of hearings, subcommittee hearings in state and federal affairs, on the third vote, it squeaked out of that committee on a 4-3 vote, went to the floor of the House, 21 people voted against it in the House, and it was reconsidered, and another 21 people moved for reconsideration. It's before you today, and it has, in our judgment, still has several problems in it. We do feel, however, that with some, what I believe, not to be very substantial amendments, it could be turned into a bill that we could all live with, and I think would do some of the things that 746 did. In all fairness, Bill Wyatt, who did quite a bit of work on this bill, extracted a lot of the very good points from 746 and put them into it. We, of course, are in favor of all of those. A few other problems. I have some proposed amendments, which I might pass around. And I might just, if we could refer to the bill, I might just kind of take you through and show you what our suggestions would be, which I feel would be a compromise that we could live with and would, I think, be beneficial for the hearing impaired public in the state of Oregon. First of all, referring to page 2 of the bill, all of the first part of the bill we would agree with, the information that someone selling a hearing aid or dealing a hearing aid must provide to the prospective purchaser before they consummate the sale. on down until we get to the very bottom of the page, we would change the placement slightly. And this is based on some of you have some letters on your, with your material, letters from a couple of doctors, Dr. Stewart and Dr. Mettler. We would change the statement to read this way. It is sometimes desirable for a person seeking help with a hearing problem, especially for the first time, to consult an ear doctor, period. Although hearing aids are often recommended for hearing problems, another form of treatment may be necessary. The major change we made to that section was to take out and obtain a clinical hearing evaluation. Our medical experts tell us that that's a decision to be made by medical staff. If you see an ear doctor and he feels that you should then be subjected to another batch of examinations, he can determine that. The testimony of prior hearings indicated that actually, of course, witnesses go different ways. One group of witnesses suggested that only 15% of the people who wear hearing aids really can be helped by medical people. We're saying we should give them a statement telling them it's sometimes desirable to see medical people. And later on in the bill, we require that in many instances they have to be sent to medical specialists. But we do not feel that we should also tell them they should both be seen by an ear specialist and also have to have a clinical hearing evaluation. We think that duplicitous, and the doctor should decide that if a doctor and expert feels that that is necessary, it should be done. So that's the change here. On the next page, the major change would be down around lines 19 and 20. I'll read it, line 17, and I'll read in my changes, and I'll tell you why we propose these changes. Mm-hmm. No temporary certificate of registration shall be issued by the division under this section unless the applicant shows to the satisfaction of the division that he is or will be under the direction, supervision, control, and training of a person who holds a valid certificate of registration issued under so-and-so. The change we made was to take out direct supervision and insert instead direction, supervision, control, and training. The reason for this is we're concerned as to what direct supervision might be. If you have, the way it works, a hearing aid dealer has people working under him that are called temporary certificate holders. Oregon gives the examination twice a year, and prior to the examination, one can get experience and learn the information needed to help pass the examination by working under a special certificate under a already licensed hearing aid dealer. We're concerned that the word under the direct supervision might mean that every moment of the day this person has to be held by the hand by the licensee. Of course, he has to learn how to repair hearing aids and do various things on his own. The dealer can't be sitting there with him every moment of the day. We feel that the language under the direct supervision, control, and training is probably what everybody meant, and in our judgment would mean that the dealer is responsible for his activities. If he does something improper, he's the deep pocket the consumer can look to, and we think that this adequately protects the state of Oregon. The next change, the top of page 4, is the same sort of thing. The person who holds a temporary certificate of registration issued under this section is found by the division to be dealing in hearing aids without the direction, supervision, control, and training required in section 3. The division, meaning the health division, may revoke, suspend, or fail to renew the temporary certificate. The same change we made before. The next proposed change on page 5, we're setting forth a bunch of things that if a hearing aid dealer engages in, his license can be suspended or revoked. Looking down to line 23, subsection 7, his license can be suspended or revoked for fitting or dispensing a hearing aid produced by any person under the age of under 16 years of age, unless within 90 days of such sale, the child has been referred to an otolaryngologist, as you know, an ear specialist, ear, nose, throat specialist, for examination and for a recommendation of corrective measures which may be required, or B, if an otolaryngologist is not available in the community, to a properly licensed physician for life examination and recommendation. We would agree to all of that. We would propose striking the rest of that section, which goes on to say that the second referral should be to a medical doctor and an audiologist. As you may not know, there are very few audiologists in the state of Oregon. The figures in our hearings have varied between 15 and 30, but I think the highest number I heard at least was 30. I think the other people said around 20 was probably a closer figure. I imagine the health division would have the exact number. And these people are located primarily in the valley, Portland, Eugene, I think there's a couple in Medford, none down on the coast, none out in Eastern Oregon, to my knowledge. And if we required that you had to be seen by both a medical doctor and an audiologist, it would cause a great burden on people located in remote areas. Plus, again, it's our position, and the position of our medical people, the letters we pass out, the doctor should decide whether it's also necessary to send somebody to an audiologist. They're the medical specialist. An audiologist is not a medical person. And it's been thoroughly checked by a medical person, and the medical doctor should then decide what the proper route of referral is. And it shouldn't be written into the law that somebody has to go A, B, C, D, E. As long as they're sent to a medical specialist, that should suffice. So that would be our change to that section. We would agree with all of the rest of that part. Okay, the next change, and okay, the change there was to delete, would be at the line 29, with the license position for life examination recommendation period, and just delete the rest of that.
There are licensed physicians who are not medical physicians. They are of other medical arts. Do you mean a licensed medical doctor, or do you mean a licensed physician of one of the medical arts?
Well, that's a
chiropractic physician is a licensed physician, is he not?
Okay, that may well be. Maybe he's a licensed doctor.
Not only well, maybe, but is.
Okay, I would. I think that's what we're all intending. Skipping now over to page 6. Section 6, this has to do with the rescission clause. We propose in 746, the hearing aid dealer's bill, the right for anyone to rescind a hearing aid transaction for any reason within 30 days. A brand new provision. Right now, caveat emptor, a sale is a sale, and buyer beware. We propose that it's kind of like a trial approval plan, that they have 30 days to try it out. I understand that this matter came up, this bill came up very unexpectedly yesterday, and that some amendments were proposed, and I have taken those amendments into consideration in our amendments to Section 6. And if I can, try to clarify, I'll read for you what Section 6 would now provide. It would start as it is, so only the number 1 would be deleted. It would start, in addition to any other rights and remedies you may have, the purchaser of a hearing aid shall have the right to rescind the transaction if, and then it skips over to the next page, line 10, only the first few words by the purchaser given written, we put written out, it just says, the purchaser gives notice of his intent to rescind the transaction to the seller at his place of business by certified mail returning to request, which notice shall be posted not later than, and again, we feel 30 days is reasonable, it got amended to 60 days along the way. We think it's a major step forward, and 30 days should be the appropriate period. So in our amendments, we would suggest 30 days. Following the date of delivery, and the record is all the same, the record of the seller shall without request, refund, etc. Then down at the very end, in which event the purchaser shall incur no additional liability for such cancellation, that would be changed to a comma, and these are again out of the amendments that you were given yesterday, and either, colon, then we would jump back to page 6, line 34, the purchaser, for whatever reason, consults an ear doctor, we change it to, or, if none available within his community, then a licensed physician, maybe we should again call that licensed doctor, subsequent to purchasing the aid, and such ear doctor or licensed physician advises such purchaser against purchasing or using a hearing aid, and in writing specifies the medical reasons for such advice, and the purchaser returns the hearing aid to the seller or holds it at the seller's disposal in its original condition, less normal wear and tear, or the seller in his dealings with the purchaser committed any act listed in subsection 2 to 16 of section 5 of the 1975 Act or failed to provide the statement required by section 2 of the 1975 Act. As you see, the major change I made there, or we made there, or proposed there, was to take out audiologists. Here's the problem we have. We have two non-medical groups, audiologists who engage in hearing sessions, hearing aid dealers who engage in hearing sessions. Needless to say, my people are most concerned if an audiologist can say, to write out a slip of paper, say, take the hearing aid back, or if you want to get out of the deal, I can write out a slip of paper saying you should take it out, you should get your, you should be able to rescind the transaction. We're very happy to have ear doctors or any other licensed doctor, if they feel somebody should not be wearing a hearing aid for any medical reason, to state that. No objections. We propose that. We will be happy to live with it. And we think that gives substantial protection to the hearing impaired public of the state of Oregon. We are, of course, most concerned that audiologist would say, wait a minute, here, I'll write down a question to get back. Because if it's going to be a rescission for that kind of reason, it should be upon a medical doctor's statement. And that's our change to that. The rest of the bill, the only other change, and I'll have to refer now to the amendment, on page 2 of our proposed amendment, section 9 speaks to the audiologist law. We provide no person licensed as an audiologist may fit or dispense a hearing aid for use by a person under 16 years of age unless within 90 days of such sale the child has been referred A, to an otolaryngologist, which is an ear doctor, for examination and for a recommendation of corrective measures that may be required, or B, if an otolaryngologist is not available in this community, to a properly licensed physician for life examination and recommendation. And we go on to give the exclusion if for religious reasons the person does not wish to go.
Yes, any question?
Excuse me, George, I thought we took that out.
We did.
And the reason was these people can't sell hearing aids unless they are licensed and certified.
That's right, but they can fit and dispense. Here's the distinction. What is a sale? A sale is where you apparently, you make an offer which somebody accepts. Someone comes into an audiologist and says, I think I've got a hearing problem, I'd like to wear a hearing aid. They can say, well, here, let me check you. Yes, you said you use a model 232 tri-electronic hearing aid, and you can get that by calling the tri-electronic 232-947. They can mail it. The audiologist fits it, puts it on. We're just saying all of the evidence in the 30 hours of hearing we had on this bill is if you're dealing with children under 16 years of age, they should have prior medical clearance. And we're saying, fine, we agree with that, we support it, it was in our bill. We feel everybody fitting and dispensing aid, whether they're selling the aid or whether they're indirectly dispensing the aid from someone else, if it's to a child under 16 years of age, they should be examined and cleared by a medical specialist. And that's our only point of that. I do know that the audiologists now wish to take out that section. Our proposed amendments would leave it in as the children under the age of 16.
Are there other questions with your unknown?
No person may sell or dispense a hearing aid.
That would settle the whole thing. We would agree with that 100%. And or it could be yes, we would agree. No person. And we can leave that as part of the right in the hearing aid unit law.
No sell or dispense.
Right.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Allen. Senator Gronis?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, if I said anything on the recommendations, I think George covered it very well, but the only thing I'd like to say, I think the leaders are doing very well by health and safety standards. It would indicate this, and I certainly support the amendment to this bill that Mr. Ragnar has
suggested. All right. As I said before, we're going to leave House Bill 2165 for a temporary period, and we'll get back to it as time allows. There are other bills we have to act on. Let's turn to 2598 first.
Oh, I don't know.
I know, 2958. Mr. Redden was here this morning and testified on the bill. It sets up a council which is permissive that can counsel with local government entities in selling the bond. Do you want to add anything to that?
No.
Is there a motion on the bill?
Yes.
Senator Brown moves House Bill 2598 to pass.
2958, right? 2958, is that one there?
Right.
Yes, okay. Chris, what was it?
Discussion?
Yes, I may. Thank you.
Clerk call roll.
Debbie
Brown.
Aye.
Debbie Brown.
Aye.
Debbie Brown.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Senate Bill 2. The afternoon is good. I think it's in good order, but not that. Move to the floor, if you can. And the Robert 2 Senate Bill 2 to the floor. It will be here. Clerk call roll. Devin Brown.
Aye.
Carson.
Aye.
Robert.
Aye.
Ann.
Wow. Oh, that's good. How are you? I'll pass it along.
Are you sure it's
broken order?
Aye. Senate Bill 3168 is done.
Something.
3166.
Okay.
John, you want to make your observation on this bill?
Madam Chairman, this is a bill that Representative Corey introduced, and it has to do is decide to take out statutes, particularly licensing statutes, reference to moral privileges. One thing the committee should be aware of, that is that where you take out moral turpitude in many instances, you're broadening the basis upon which a licensing board might suspend licenses. For instance, the criteria that's listed in many professional licensing statutes is that a board might suspend or revoke a license based upon a conviction of a felony or a misdemeanor involving moral turpitude. Where you delete involving moral turpitude, you're expanding that basis then to all misdemeanors. There is, however, in each instance, qualification on that, in that at the last session, the legislature passed a statute which says that a licensing board cannot deny someone a license or suspend or revoke solely on the basis that they've been convicted of a crime. So you're taking away, first of all, you're broadening the basis upon which a suspension might occur, but you still have this other statute which, to some extent, provides protection by saying that a board can't affect a license solely because somebody has been convicted of a crime. How much of a protection that is, I don't know, considering the difficulty of proving that a decision was made based solely upon the conviction of a crime.
I don't know if Mr. Before I recognize ramifications that John has suggested here.
I don't know if they're willing to guess or deny.
Madam Chairman, Fred Neal is here from Legislative Council, and I think he was aware of that. Fred could speak to that particular point.
If you want to briefly address
yes,
would you come up and state your name, please?
Fred Neal, in the Legislative Council's office, did most of the work of drafting this proceeding, and he was well aware of the problem, and he felt that 7280 when passed by the legislature last session, as it stated, limits consideration of the conviction of any crime in a professional licensing situation to simply the fact of leading to the conviction of the crime and intervening fact that would relate to the professional standards or operational duties of that license. And it was Representative Corey's feeling that that statute narrows the review of a conviction of any crime that a licensing agency has, whereas moral turpitude is undefinable. And that's an open door for abuse by the licensing agency to have arbitrary decisions. In fact, moral turpitude has not been previously defined.
Questions? Thank you very much.
If
you have any
suggestions,
if I could
ask you a question. Let's take, for example, a practical matter. I'm looking at page 3 of the bill, and we're talking about jurors, lines 4 and 5. And apply this discussion we're having here. If there's no person who's competent to act as a juror has been convicted of any felony, it used to say, or a misdemeanor involving moral turpitude. So, there are two changes in that one. One is that you could be convicted of a misdemeanor involving moral turpitude, or whatever it may be, and you still serve on a jury. So it's not just removing moral turpitude, it's another aspect of it, too. What does the judge, what kind of felony interferes with being a juror?
No, not that.
Well, see, that problem is that moral turpitude is hard enough to define.
Right.
But you can eliminate some of those things that clearly don't involve moral turpitude. Now we're thrown back into the other law that says, in effect, that you can't be a juror if you've been convicted of a crime that involves, that relates to your function as a juror. I guess that's what we're thrown back to.
Yeah, I don't think so, but Number one, like I said, from my understanding, reading through all these licenses and statutes, the where it says prison convicted of any felony or misdemeanor involving moral turpitude, death. Second part is together. I mean, it's not a felony involving moral turpitude, but any felony.
Okay.
Convicted of any felony would be ground for revocation or denial of the license.
I guess you're right.
Default taken for sure.
Yeah, but in your packet, a list of all of the sections that are affected by it and also proposed amendments. Are these amendments agreeable to Representative Tafoya?
Yes.
What do they do?
The amendments on pages 1 and 2 are housekeeping amendments. I think the numbers referred to, there are so many statutes involved in bills that so it's apparently moral turpitude or possibly. So that we had to go through the numbers referred to. These are just internal to the statutes themselves and the mere housekeeping amendments. Look at professional licensing statutes primarily, and so we missed some. There's no way to comprehensively go through the ORS and read it word for word and pick out these elements. So we did find that the licensing of the trial pairing organization, one that proved its good character and good intention. I can't say, and I won't speak to the vagaries of the remainder of that. So we found that an OLCE permit applicant had proved his good moral character, or if he were a corporation, then good moral character of his board of directors. And not obtain a license to extend narcotics, one has proved one's good moral character. So we're just covering that. Going on, and pages 7 and 15 cover the farm labor contractor. Again, pretty good moral character and good repute. Then the 16 and 18 deal with the amendment would allow the board of optometrists to determine what moral standards a person must have to practice optometry. Then pages 18 and 19, the last amendment on the repute, would delete the requirement that an applicant for a licensed practice pharmacy pay a fee to have his moral character and reputation investigated from the state of for a foreign pharmacy.
Good question. Thank you very much. Any motions on the bill? Not a big deal, man. It was not a big deal. And these are all the different right? Bring a motion that's at 2070. Well, wait, we have witnesses on that. We'll come back to it. Let's look at 2242. We've mixed a lot here.
If you don't submit on a series, you don't have to show the stars. Or the next
question. Next,
2242. Sorry, I wasn't available, Madam Chairman. For the record, Michael Collette, State Solicitor General. The bill is an expansion upon the present rape law by providing some specific language with respect to the kind of threat which may be made by the offender against the victim. At least I hope that's the bill I'm talking about.
Yeah.
It's been a bad morning. The expansion in language, while it will create some prosecutor problems, is probably justified in terms of the kinds of cases that I personally have seen as a prosecutor and other prosecutors have described, where there is no doubt that the threat to carry out a future kind of harm, either to the victim or to the family of the victim, did serve as a coercive tactic to force the consent sexual intercourse, which the other way would not suggest. The matter of while it will be difficult to prosecute has more merit than the problems it creates in the practice.
Question?
Madam Chairman,
yeah.
That couldn't the same conduct be covered under the coercion statute?
The same conduct is covered under the coercion statute. The problem lies in the fact that coercion is a Class C felony and rape is a Class A felony, and it seems to me to distinguish. We're talking about the same kind of assault issue here, you know, the same kind of antisocial behavior in terms of the trauma that's administered to the victim. But to make the distinction depend upon whether or not I promise to beat the brains of your children out right now or I promise to do it a week from Tuesday, it's really kind of an anomaly.
One other question. Are you aware of any other crimes against persons other than coercion where there is no requirement of some immediacy to the injury threatened? For instance, menacing refers to some immediate or imminent harm, robbery the same way. All of the assault statutes against persons have to do with an injury inflicted. But extortion, crime against property to some extent against person is the only other crime that I can see.
Extortion
doesn't require that. Yeah.
Extortion and extortion carry the same kind of conduct. Threat to future conduct and to complete the crime, kidnapping does also, but kidnapping involves both the present assault and a future threat. And that is just carry that future.
Third question? Motion on the desk. Ramit Smith, Hospital 2342, out in detail. Discussion? Clerk Calvo.
Martin?
Aye.
Robert?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Dan Cameron?
Aye. Yes, thank
you. You want to say?
Central 773.
You have a few amendments to it, maybe?
Yeah, done.
In your packet.
No, Chairman, yes, the amendments are in the packet. I don't know if you have heard of it. Yeah, from the Attorney General's office. I think he can speak to this in more detail than I, but the amendments would gut the bill as it is currently printed and insert the repealer of the crime of public intoxication and also delete the authorization for political subdivisions of the state to enact ordinances which would parallel the state's public intoxication statute. And Keith can probably go into the reasons for this better than I can.
Ms. Merriman?
Can you first speak to the problem of germaneness? Keith, I just wonder if you could first speak to the question of germaneness. It appears that that question very easily could be raised. Have you given any thought?
Yes, I think all I can say on that is that the original bill dealt with intoxication, and this bill deals with that general subject matter. So that's really all I can say on that. I think there's enough of a relationship so that the rules are not being violated. I have up here with the Madam Chairman, Melinda Woodward from the Mental Health Division. She's the coordinator of the alcohol treatment programs, and she can also answer the questions that they might have. The basic problem is that in 1974, the federal government passed a law essentially declaring that alcohol could be treated as an illness and providing grants to the state if they had programs that met the federal standards and similarly treated the alcoholism as an illness rather than a crime. Now, the key federal requirement that we're concerned about here was a requirement that the state have repealed those statutes. Have repealed those criminal statutes and ordinances under which drunkenness is the gravamen of a petty criminal offense, such as loitering, vagrancy, or disturbing the peace. Right now, we still have on the books ORS 166.035, which defines the crime of public intoxication. That is, a person commits the crime of public intoxication if he creates, while in the state of intoxication, any disturbance of the public in any public or private business or place. We were asked our opinion as to whether our laws were consistent with the federal statutes, and this one fact gave us concern. In addition, as the committee counsel stated, the political subdivisions are authorized in an act of parallel law. So essentially all our amendments do is one, repeal the statute defining the public intoxication as a crime, and two, amend the statute authorizing political subdivisions to enact parallel ordinance to eliminate that authorization. The way that statute would now read after the amendment is that a political subdivision in the state shall not adopt or enforce, which makes clear that any existing ordinances that would authorize the defining of as a crime the petty offenses where alcoholism is involved, that would repeal those ordinances. That's essentially the reason we're here. There's approximately $452,000 in grant money over a 3-year period involved. We put an emergency clause on the bill because the federal regulations state at the time the application is submitted, the state must have put into effect these repealers. We haven't done that yet, but I think the emergency clause will take care of that problem. Now, Ms. Woodard can answer any questions you have concerning the state's program.
Yeah, make a brief statement on the program.
My name is Melinda Woodward, and I had a return statement. I suppose that the one thing I can tell you is that the grant funds that would come to the state as a result of our qualifying under the Uniform Act provisions of the 1974 Amendment would be used in three areas of the state where right now there is still a heavy public intoxication problem. And these three areas now have treatment facilities, but one of the things they're lacking are people to help the police pick up intoxicated people and take them to the treatment facilities. So the police are still having to bear the burden of transportation of intoxicated people to treatment facilities. So we would need the grant funds to help to supplement the police in outreach efforts to take intoxicated people to treatment facilities.
Other questions?
Maybe I have one more comment to Madam Chairman. And that is, I don't think these amendments will prohibit the cities and counties from punishing conduct that amounts to disturbing the peace or disorderly conduct. I think what it will prohibit is ordinances defining conduct that has as one of the essential elements in intoxication. So I think the cities and counties still will retain considerable flexibility to punish if they must conduct disturbing of the public or disorderly or what have you. The main point, I think, of the federal act is to change the basic attitude of the state and the local political subdivisions and the approach to alcohol.
Then I see you're saying that we lose $450,000 in federal funds if
there is that distinct possibility. I don't know what the federal government would be, how they will react to the fact that we have this statute on the books now, which makes public intoxication a crime. Possibly they might be able to overlook it, but this is the reason we have these amendments before you, because at least on its face, that statute conflicts with the federal requirement that the state has repealed these kinds of statutes.
Any motion on the amendments? Senator Brown moves to delete the provisions of Senate Bill 773 and substitute the amendment offered by Mr. Herman. Discussion?
I have a question. Is it accurate that we still have? Is the statement accurate that we still have the identifying intoxication as a crime? I thought we removed that from the state statute.
No.
It's still on the statute
now.
Yes.
Madam Chairman. Yes. The one thing is that the crime now does have as one element public intoxication, but you also have to show public disturbance. You can't be convicted simply for being in public and being intoxicated, but very definitely an element is intoxication.
But something else has to do with it,
right.
Not just being intoxicated.
Are you discussing
is this addressing itself to that state law? I don't listen to it.
Yes, it repeals that state law.
Which one is it? 166
Okay.
Senator
Brown. We're repealing public intoxication, but what about the disorderly aspect of it? What if you have public intoxication involving disorderly? I would
my understanding that was the election law, but as I look now at subsection C here, is drunk and disorderly conduct is being taken off the books.
Right. And
is that a mandate of the federal government in order to qualify
you? Right.
There would be nothing on regarding disorderly conduct.
Well, that's the point I just made. If the counties wanted or cities wanted to define the crime of disorderly conduct, I think they may still do so, even under these amendments, providing that they don't require as an element of that ordinance intoxication.
Breach of the peace then still is a
breach of the peace, which could still be a crime. But a lot of these ordinances, and I think this is what the federal government is getting at, also included part of it, the intoxication element.
Oh, why didn't you make a definition of disorderly conduct and put it in here?
We could. I think, are you speaking now for the state? Or
yeah.
Madam Chairman, that's already defined. There is a crime of disorderly conduct on the state statute now. The class B misdemeanor.
And this is not repealing it?
No.
Oh.
Will we not be qualified to request federal funds if this is not passed?
We've already requested the grant. The question is whether our application qualifies under the federal statute because of the fact we have on the books, both at the state level and the county and the city level, statutes and ordinances which define public intoxication or disturbing the peace as a crime. And then an element of that is intoxication. And that's precisely the prohibition of the federal statute that the state will have repealed those crimes under which drunkenness is the gravamen of a petty criminal offense, such as loitering, vagrancy, or disturbing the peace. Now, that public intoxication, an element of that offense is. Even though it's serving the peace, is intoxication. So I think these amendments are necessary, at least to assure that our grant application will qualify.
Mm-hmm.
We have not yet.
My question is, I heard it stated, are all of them necessary?
Well, we didn't touch the statute as it was adopted in 1973. All we've changed is subsection A, 1A, which has exceptions that permits political subdivisions to adopt a local law or regulation identical to ORS 166035. And that is the public intoxication.
Okay. The amendment is before us. There's a discussion on the amendment. That's to make a better bill, Arlene. I think it was just a good moment.
What's the call
along?
Carson? Taylor?
No.
Robert?
Smith?
No.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. Motion failed. 2582. Mr. Webb? Sorry. Do you want to say anything on this?
Madam Chairman, it appears one of my votes is done.
All right, we will go back to 2165. Since we are limited in time and we have an equal number of people signed up in it for the bill and against it, I'm going to take some of each in case we don't exhaust the list. Lloyd Ettinger? Lloyd Ettinger? Is Mr. Ettinger here?
I'm sorry to be absent at the moment when I was called. I would like, if I may, to depart from my written comments to reply to some of the things that the hearing with either lobbyist Mr. George Reiner stated. And then I'd like to raise some questions that I think have to be considered. First of
of all, it's important to realize that House Bill 2165, being gross, is a product of many hours of the Prime Minister's consideration and thought about many aspects of a problem. He refers to audiology. Being an audiologist, I think that there are something that has to be pointed out. The profession of audiology, contrary to what he implied, does not go back to 1973. In fact, I have given each of you a copy of definitions from the Dictionary of Occupational Titles, which is dated 1955, but it doesn't date back to 1965 either. It goes back to 1941, World War II. And it's the reason for the profession of audiology relates partly to the problems we're having here today. Audiology arose from a need for consumer protection. Audiology came into being during World War II to assist veterans in getting a fair shake and getting a hearing aid. This has persisted to the present time. Unfortunately, this means that audiology sometimes steps on the toes of hearing aid dealers when the consumer's interests are at heart. This is not to say that all dealers are dishonest. There are some dealers in this room for whom I have the highest respect. But audiology has served as a consumer protection profession, among many other things. And I would call your attention to the Dictionary of Occupational Titles and Descriptions of the various occupations described here. Let me raise some questions. What has Mr. Reinmiller really said? What were his amendments to 2165 be engrossed intend to do? Were they designed to help the consumer? Were any of his amendments proposed to enhance the cause of the consumer? Or were they instead designed to eliminate or to play down the role of the audiologist? Section 2, line 31, and I don't have the copy that I marked while he was here, but I think I can refer to these things, where he would eliminate reference under the little warning that a person would read before they bought a hearing aid, he would eliminate reference to a clinical hearing evaluation. Why? Couldn't a person be advised to have a hearing evaluation by an impartial body? What can that hurt? It can do an awful lot of good. We see this.
Are audiologists available all over the state?
They are available through the most of the state, from Medford to Portland.
Not during stages under.
There are some people who I believe, I don't have my list here, who are licensed audiologists in that area, although I do not have my list here. I cannot confirm that at this point. But there are audiologists through the state. There are some 55, I believe, otolaryngologists, and I believe the number is 30 or 35 licensed audiologists.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Senator Brown.
You say that there had been lots of work done on this. Could an audiologist with a PhD be interpreted by the public to be an ear doctor?
No. I would say absolutely no. First of all, because we make every effort to clarify for the consumer the fact that we are audiologists. We see our role is side by side with ENT, not in competition.
Exactly, no, that's all. Thank you.
I want to just mention a few other things. In sections 5 and 6, he would eliminate any reference to audiologists. For children under age 16, for rescinding a sale. Now, how would elimination of this help the consumer? How possibly can that help the consumer? At section 9, he made a point of referring to section 9. And in section 9, which makes the reference to the audiology and speech pathology licensing bill. And this section 9 is actually redundant with the bill itself, because in section 5, 7, it states that before any hearing aid can be fit or dispensed, a person would have to see a medical doctor. The House Bill 2165 already provides for that. Section 9 is absolutely redundant. I guess the whole spirit of it, it's become something quite regrettable. The intention of House Bill 2165 was never to downplay or to eliminate the role of a hearing aid dealer. Hearing aids are not going to be sold by anyone but hearing aid dealers. The intention of House Bill 2165, I agree that the original version was not a good version. It has been changed. The intention has never been to enhance or to fill the pocketbook that has been stated of certain professions. I'm busy enough. I've been busy for
7 years. I haven't had time. I've never had an opening in my appointment book over 2 weeks in advance. The purpose has been to help the consumer. It's been turned into an inference that audiologists and physicians are now turning against the hearing aid unit. I think this is terribly regrettable. The focus has to be on the consumer and what can be done for the consumer. And House Bill 2165, as it is written, is a tremendous consumer bill. It's ahead of others in the nation. I think that's all I have.
Would you look on page 5, lines 28 through 32? Why is it necessary after a physician has seen a person with an ear defect, if he solves the problem, why is it necessary that he refer him to an audiologist?
You're thinking of a general physician, general practitioner, perhaps. The reason most general practitioners and physicians would prefer to refer to an audiologist.
They have that discretion without putting it in the law. Anytime they want to, they can.
They can.
Why are we telling them they have to?
I think it simply points out to many the importance of non-medical problems which can often be present. Let's take, for example, a 5-year-old child. I've seen this sort of thing happen. I don't have any cases with me to document, but let's just take a hypothetical example, a 5-year-old child who is seen by a physician for an ear infection type of problem. That ear infection type of problem is something that is resolved by a physician and not by an audiologist. But when that problem has been resolved, if that child's communication abilities are still hampered, as they well may be, an audiological evaluation can confirm that there is not an additional different type of loss in addition to that. And this is necessary. This is absolutely necessary for the protection of a child, or an adult for that matter, who could have a hearing loss of multiple causes. We couldn't agree more that child should see a physician. He should also be seen by an audiologist. An audiologist has years of training in assessing hearing disorders, as well as rehabilitation of children with hearing disorders and adults.
Thank you, Justin. Thank you very much. Ron Schur.
Chairman Brown, due to the interest of time, I was asked by Dr. Mettler to read this letter, many of the statements that he's made in the letter been presented by George Lionel, so I'd like to defer my time to maybe a consumer that's interested in the bill and to Hank Burford from Mount Hood Community College. The only point that I would like to bring out is that Dr. Mettler also disagrees with the fact that audiologists should be in the exemption of a contract. He feels that the O&O guidelines should be adequate to determine if a person should or should not be wearing a ring. So if I could see my time at 3:28.
You'll be calling the order. Is that all you have to say?
Yes.
Question? Thank you very much. Dr. Ella Young?
I'm Dr. Ella Young, Director of the Speech and Hearing Center at Oregon College of Education. The testimony that I'm presenting is on my own behalf and does not represent that of the state system of higher education, nor that of Oregon College of Education. I would like to point out two aspects of the previous testimony and indicate that the previous testimony and amendments that have been incorporated in the engrossed copy of 2165 represent many hours of deliberation and many hours of work on behalf of a number of people who are competent in their field. And I would suggest that the amendments that were proposed by the lobbyists for the Oregon Hearing Aid Dealers Association are not necessary, not essential, and in fact weaken the consumer protection aspect of House Bill 2165. There was the fact that there are at least 28 or more different possible causes of hearing impairment, many of which are very subtle in their appearance and which require
battery test to determine the site of lesions, to determine whether or not there may be the possibility of neurological involvement, which has not been indicated here. Sometimes a hearing loss may be one of the first indications of, for instance, a tumor of the eighth nerve.
Sorry, you're not a doctor.
No, I'm not.
What is your profession?
My profession is audiology.
Okay.
And my training has been, a large portion of my training was at LSU, Louisiana State University Medical School in New Orleans. And I served in the VA. I served in the charity hospital in New Orleans on the otolaryngology staff and on the neurology staff as an audiologist, working with pediatric otolaryngology and neurology. And it is not just otolaryngology that is involved. Oftentimes, referrals are made to neurology. And I would like to indicate that these are very important considerations because they affect the general health. And oftentimes, the very first indication of a major health problem of major proportion is picked up in an initial audiological evaluation. And this is, I would like to submit this testimony and the indications are in the testimony that has been passed out. Thank you very much.
Questions? Thank you very much. Gary Robinson?
My name is Gary Robinson, and I'm here in the interview. And I'm concerned with the bill in its present form, 2155, in as much as the individuals that I deal with in East Multnomah County, Hood River County, Wasco County, Sherman, Dillon, Morrow County, if I find that I have to serve each individual that I work with, and I'm responsible for the service of approximately 4,000 hearing aid users in those counties, I find that it may be to the disinterest of those individuals to refer them into Portland to have a subsequent test by an audiologist. I would be concerned as well that, for example, when I'm working with Kepner, the only audiologist that I have access to is through the IED in Lexington. The closest otolaryngologist, and there are two, in Walla Walla, and there are two in Richmond. That's close. Otherwise, I mean, when I do find a conductive loss, I find it off. I have those options, or in the Portland. And certainly, when I'm the least concerned, I would make the referral. But when I'm forced to do this with each individual that I work with, or before someone purchases a hearing aid, if they have to have an extra test, I think it would not be in the best interest of these individuals. And that's my concern. I would like to see, certainly I would like to see more perception for the individual. But on the other hand, I would like to see a certain equity here. And while there are many features of 2155 that I wholeheartedly endorse, there are some that I think should just have some careful hearing before it passed.
So thank you, Mr. Robinson. Thank you very much. Hey,
I'm Hank Burford, Director for Community Education at Albert Community College. My comments here today will not reflect Albert Community College, but my own is my own. And perhaps what I'm going to speak to is not what's in the bill so much, but what isn't. My first contact with any of the hearing aid dealers in the state of Oregon was about 3 years ago when they approached me on setting up some type of continuing education program. And through progress through the past 3 years and working with them, we have set up individual classes, like an audiometric technique. And they have sent out, I think about 3 or 4 different occasions, notices to dealers in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and even Alaska. And we hold these on like a weekend or a 3-day shot, all day session, to get into 30 hours. And people from all these states come to take this course. Well, we also now are in the process of setting up a 1-year certificate program, of which 15 hours of that, or half, would be hardcore audiometric type courses. Now, I said here today, and I've listened to the word consumer protection being batted around, and I'm not an expert either in hearing aid fitting and extension or in audiology. I only know about it from my periphery working with it in the last 3 years. But I do see a definite wall between the audiologist and the hearing aid dealer. That's my own opinion. Now, what is an audiologist? Someone who has 4 or 5 years of college education, how much of that is directly related to audiology? Probably 30 to 40 hours. Now, how much of that 30 to 40 hours is directly related to the fitting and dispensing of hearing aids? I don't know. But I submit to you that the hearing aid dealers, if I just looked at this bill, somebody from the outside, I would get the impression that they were people who lurked in the dark to prey on senior citizens. And that has not been my impression of them at all. They have been pushing for continuing education. And some of the audiologists, not necessarily from this state, but from other states at national conventions that I've attended, aren't really too anxious to even get that. And I don't understand that either. So this is one point that I would like to bring up. I believe that the dealers, and I'm told that this other bill that is in progress, has a continuing education element in there. I think that is a strong area. As far as I'm concerned, as a colleague, we have looked at this no differently than we would someone in the insurance business or in the real estate business. The group of people, more than a profession, who have come to us and said, hey, we would like to set up a certificate program, something that we can require our people to take so that we can police them better. To me, that's a logical step. And again, speaking as a novice or a consumer, as long as people are required to see a medical doctor, to me, I don't know what better protection you can have than that.
Question? Take it to the first. Dr. Steve Faust?
I'm an audiologist at Second Administration Hospital. The testimony that I present today is my own. Could not be interpreted to reflect the policies of Second Administration Hospital. House Bill 2165, as originally introduced in the House Committee on Aging, was a bill that the audiology community did not support, contrary to the popular opinions on reported here today and in past days. In fact, if you will review the records, you will see that every audiologist that came to that hearing opposed the bill in its current state. Now, as far as the current 2165, and listening to the testimony today, it is again apparent that there are one heck of a lot of misinterpretation regarding what a consumer would have to do with 2165, as it is being wrote. In front of you, you see a brief breakdown of 2165 in its current form. You will notice that it's an amendment to the hearing aid dealer's current piece of certificate of registration piece of legislation, which was enacted correctly 15 years ago, but not by the influence of the dealer community, but by the influence of the professional community. Now, as you can see, it has the support of the Washington County Council on Aging, a consumer group, the City County Multnomah Council on Aging, another consumer group, the Oregon Speech and Hearing Association, and the Oregon Medical Association. Now, I would assume that these are pretty good endorsements. I have in the past presented written testimony from individuals at the University of Oregon Medical School and Otolaryngology supporting 2165. I find it a little hard to determine the reason for the number of objections and amendments added to this bill on this date. I think I can hypothesize in my own mind why this was done. But it isn't as though there hasn't been 30 hours of testimony and several work sessions involving both participants. And if you want to look at the bill, you see that it is not, and read the face cover, you see that it is not an audiologist bill. It is a consumer protection bill. The terms otolaryngology, the terms medical doctor appear more frequently than do the terms audiologist. There are the synopsis in front of you, what the House Bill 2165 does do. It only advises the purchaser over age 16 that these other services possibly should be sought out for his own protection. And it requires with a waiver clause, the kids under 16 be evaluated by an MD or an audiologist and an MD in combination. And as far as providing services to this classification of person, the public health department holds otology clinics throughout the state, in Baker, in Pendleton, in which they screen audiometrically and have staff by otolaryngologist clinics for these children. So I don't see there's a problem of providing services, because the services are there by the professionals to be provided. And the other thing that I think is very important this does is that it identifies for the consumer where he can file a complaint if he happens to have one. Currently, a consumer buying a hearing aid does not know where to file a complaint. Sure, you know, at the State Department of Health, you and I might know that, but there's no written piece of information available to the individual currently. And the one problem of the purchaser having some right of rescinding the contract with the hearing aid dealer, I contend, and Dr. Dave DeWeese would contend, that there are other reasons other than medical reasons for rescinding a hearing aid. An example of a medical reason for rescinding the purchase of a hearing aid would be if the hearing aid is fit on a person that has a chronic draining ear, or if he has a plug of cerumen or earwax in his ear, and it's removed and no longer needs the hearing aid, the deal should be rescinded. But an audiologic reason for rescinding a hearing aid would be if a hearing aid is put on an ear that has no hearing sensitivity in it, a dead ear, in other words. Or if a hearing aid is put on an ear that gives some pure tone threshold, but when speech is made loud enough for the person to hear, he can't understand a thing he's hearing. Again, that is a very legitimate reason for questioning the authenticity of putting that hearing aid on the ear. So, and the objections of what the bill, you know, to clear up what it does not do, it doesn't restrict hearing aid sales by qualified hearing dealers. It doesn't rule out sales or service to the homebound. It doesn't make the services of an audiologist or physician mandatory. It does not pave the way for physicians or audiologists to sell hearing aids. And it does not limit continuing education. There is nothing in these amendments that says if the hearing aid dealers want to develop a continuing education course at Mount Hood or Portland State University or Eugene or Corvallis, it doesn't say that they can't do that. In fact, this particular amendment says that as far as providing a higher quality of education for their trainees through direct supervision by the licensed hearing aid dealer, it makes the provision for a better trained hearing aid dealer in the end result, and that the individual is not going to be sent out on his own after a little bit of orientation, but that he's going to have to be more closely observed and supervised. And I guess to conclude, I would only say that the educational qualifications, and I'm not here, and I'm not going to get into the problem of arguing proficiencies or levels of expertise. I will let established academic programs that involve 6 years of coursework and the minimum of a master's degree plus 1 year of clinical fellowship work under a licensed audiologist or certified audiologist and passing a national board examination to stand as qualification that says, I know what I'm doing. And on the other hand, I would suggest that the lay public that comes in contact with each professional or with each group would have a hard time distinguishing that.
Thank you. Hearing Mark.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Harry L. Mark. I'm a hearing aid dealer in Portland, Oregon, with 33 years of experience in the profession. And of course, you've heard the pros and cons. I would like to bring up some areas which I think are important for consideration. And this is on page 2, line 24, where it requires that we put on all sales contracts, not only the address of the health division, but a procedure for making complaints under this act. To the best of my knowledge, I know of no other profession or no other contract where an individual is compelled to write into where you go to make complaints. It is normally considered that if a complaint is to be made, the complaint would be made with the individual who has written the contract or has sold the product. Why we are being discriminated, I do not know. The Health Division to date, and I believe this is in transcript and on record, has received 1/20 of 1% complaints in the hearing aid industry over the period that we have been registered. Also over this period, the industry has upgraded itself, policed itself, and has done a far better job than most states in the union of serving the hard of hearing public. All of a sudden, when the dealers decided to upgrade themselves and put an act that had continuing education and some other provisions that we could better police ourselves for the benefit of the public, there was another act introduced in order to counteract the one that would upgrade our industry, and instead there's been remarks made to downgrade it. On page 3, line 2, after making the statement that it says in the law that you must require a signature indicating they have read it, and then in addition they must understand it. I don't know how you could define that. How are we to know that they have definitely understood it? We can explain it, we can tell them, they will nod their head, they will agree and say yes, I understand it. But later on they say, gee, I didn't understand it.
Maybe they couldn't hear it.
That is quite possible. But it is in writing, and they should be able to read it if they couldn't hear it. So after what they have read and after what we have said, if they can't understand it, how do we define that? But it's written into law that we must say that they understood it, and I can see different things coming up later on where that could be. Now, we had one gentleman up here said that he was so busy that he didn't have time to do anything else, so he didn't want to sell hearing aids, but he is a licensed hearing aid dealer as well as an audiologist. With no intentions of selling hearing aids, why should he be both? Now, they claim that many hours of work went in producing this bill, and yet a big portion of it was excerpted from our own bill, unless changing it around to not necessarily benefit the public, but to change it to a point that made it very difficult for us to train our men. In our bill, we had a provision that a person, before they could become a licensed dealer, would have to serve 1 year as an apprentice under a licensed dealer before he could set up his own business. Certainly, this would be more protection than the direct supervision, which would end up being, since the test is only given every 6 months, we would say then we would only start hiring somebody just before the test was given, because none of us can afford to put a man on our payroll that's non-productive for a 6 month period until he's able to take the test. If he isn't able to earn this and he must be directly under our supervision, then as long as I'm along, what do I need him for? So we would wait until that time and he'd get limited training rather than improve the training. There was a statement made that the Medical Association was behind that bill, but the Academy of Ophthalmology and Otolaryngology doesn't seem to be behind it, and they're the ear specialists. You have in your possession a letter, which, because I realize of time, I'm not going to read it to you, but I would appreciate it if the committee would read it, from Dr. Clifford Kuhn, in which he states many of the reasons that have already been brought out here and expresses it very clearly how the ear specialist feels about certain parts of the bill. There was also a statement made that there was audiologists in Eastern Oregon and that there was testing being done. This may be true as far as children are concerned, because the public school system, I believe, has a testing, not the public school, but the State Board of Health has people going around testing children's hearing. But this doesn't take care of the adults. And this is the people, the senior citizens, which seems to be the most concerned. Where are they going to get tested? They can't go back to school again. So actually, the coverage that was claimed, I would say, is not available in Eastern Oregon and many of the far-reaching parts of our state, and this is extremely important. So anything that hinders a legitimate business, I feel I'm a legitimate businessman. Over the years that I've worked with children and adults, I feel that I've done a great public service, and it hurts deeply when suddenly I find out that I'm being stepped on and sat on for what reason? I don't know of that many complaints being coming out of my office or any other office.
Thank
that
you.
Causes this.
Thank you very much. Jewel Baker?
I want to make a motion for you before we leave.
Okay.
No.
I represent the city of Abilene, and we are against House Bill 2165 being voted. I might add before we begin my testimony that we were definitely in favor of Senate Bill 743. And it was suggested to me by Mr. Dinsmore that we would be wise to make a compromise on this bill because of the time element. I went back and had a session with the senior lobby and they agreed that we should work out what we considered a compromise that would be acceptable to us for 2165. The senior lobby, as you've seen, is opposed to House Bill 2165 being built. We do not accept it as a consumer bill, nor do we consider it a bill which will benefit the elderly. We do feel that its punitive effect on the hearing aid sales and servicing brands in the industry would have the effect of eventually increasing the cost of hearing aids. For a tremendous percentage of senior citizens, the aids are already priced above our ability to pay, and we wish to avoid any course of action which will further increase this cost. House Bill 2165 would be more acceptable to us if the following revisions were to be made by this committee. First, mandatory continuing education teachers which would have the effect of upgrading the industry and would guarantee up-to-date service from dealers. Second, elimination or clarification of Section 5, Page 5, Line 9, which after describing acceptable conditions, reads, any other condition that the division may by rule establish. Now, we feel that this is too vague and could lead to abuses. Number 3, Section 5, Line 13, prohibits the use of the term doctor or other implied medical qualifications to hearing aid dealers. In all our senior lobby contacts with audiologists, these persons introduce themselves and each other as doctors. And there is nothing to indicate to the uninformed layman that this term doctor does not in fact refer to a qualified individual. We have found this misconception to be widespread, and we would appreciate it greatly if this committee could come up with a solution to this particular problem. 4, Section 6, Page 6, Lines 34 through 7, line 34 through page 7, line 1, states that if a purchaser consults a licensed physician specializing in diseases of the ear, or an audiologist and a licensed physician, in line 2, the bill states physicians are audiologists, which would seem to indicate that an audiologist alone would be empowered to order a sale revoke. We feel that the wording should be very specific and that any such cancellation of a sale should include a medical authorization. Otherwise, I am frankly of the opinion that the purchaser could become the victim in a continuing conflict between audiologists and dealers. Point 5. Under the Fair Trade Law, any article used must be resold only as used, reconditioned, or some other similar definitive term. If the audiologist is allowed to write a statement ordering the sale revoked, and the dealer is required to refund the money after 60 days of use of these aids, can only be resold as used, there is a distinct cost of probability that the cost of hearing aids would increase to cover the difference between the use money charge and the resale price of the used hearing aid. Point 5. We would like Section 9 deleted. This would also eliminate, of course, Section 8. The protective measures pertaining to children aged 16 and under are adequately covered by Section 5, Page 5, Lines 7 to 34, Page 6, Lines 1 through 8. Section 9 could be interpreted as giving audiologists the right to sell hearing aids, and it is our understanding that this is illegal in the state of Oregon. As a matter of record in the House hearing and in presentations to the senior lobby, audiologists have consistently declared themselves disinterested third parties who are necessary as a buffer between customer and dealer, and who have neither the desire nor the intent to sell hearing aids. Senior lobby asks that you consider the provisions of this bill from the viewpoint of the consumer as well as of the audiologist and the dealer. We feel that we are caught in an unhappy relationship in this struggle between two opposing factions. We would like to remind you that a large percentage of hearing aid sales are made to persons 65 and over, and therefore we have a right to be considered. We need not remind you that in these times of inflation, retired persons are trying to get along on income, which are every day as impaired as our hearing.
Question. Are you or anyone in your family engaged in hearing aid business? Thank you. Carol Mitchell.
My name is Carol Mitchell. I'm an administrative assistant with the Committee on Aging. Within the last couple of days, I've had telephone conversations with representatives from Health Education Welfare, with the Food and Drug Administration, and they're in the process of writing some recommendations, which I thought the committee ought to know about. The first recommendation from the Food and Drug Administration is that there be mandatory medical clearance for the first fitting of the hearing aid on any person. They state that a specialist is preferable, but that in cases where a specialist is not available, a general practitioner is preferable. For those under 18, there is no waiver of this specification. For adults, there is a waiver available on religious or constitutional grounds. However, the adult has to sign a statement of advice. I would imagine it would be similar to the statement of advice that can be returned to society. For subsequent fittings, if any of the seven conditions, medical conditions, are present, a dealer is not allowed to sell hearing aids. They are recommending sanctions, which include strong licensing laws and competency requirements, in addition to specified training. The FDA will call hearing aids prescription devices, and this is a sort of a modified prescription device because of the waivers that are available. They will write regulations covering all of the above points that I mentioned. And I thought you ought to know that this is what the federal government is doing. These recommendations are coming out in July, and the regulations sometime in
September could be effective when?
I'm not sure when the regulations will be accepted, but the recommendations will be published in July.
And have these already been accepted and just waiting for publication and possible changes?
They have had hearings on the recommendations. Now, I am not clear. They were going to send me written material, which probably will come in general today. Wednesday, I thought
she was gone. We expect some regulations, but there may be some changes in what you told us about, but not really clear.
Right. However, from the tone of the conversation with Mr. McDonald, I assume that most of the objections have been met because we have to change the subject of this. One of which is the religious ground waiver.
Good question. Thank you very much. Ron Stewart.
Chairman Brown, I'd like to have Don Green take my place if possible. He's the president of the Arthur Hearing Society.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and members of the committee. I will make my comments short.
No, just a minute,
please.
Yes. What is
your motion? Madam Chairman, I'd like to move to reconsider the vote by which the amendment to Senate Bill 772 is proceeding.
Is there any objection? 772 is reconsidered, then?
Madam Chairman, I would move that the amendment to 773 be adopted with the elimination of the emergency clause.
The motion is to adopt the amendment prepared by Peter Herman, but deleting the emergency clause. Is there any objection?
Then, Madam Chairman,
hearing none, the amendment is adopted.
I would move the bill out to pass with the caveat that the chairman of this committee asks the Attorney General for an interpretive opinion so that local governments will have some kinds of guidelines as to the kinds of ordinances they might write with respect to the implementation of such things.
Down, we have another option. Let's call it on, Bill.
Debbie Brown.
Aye.
Roberts.
Aye.
Smith.
Aye.
Manny Cannon.
Aye.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and members of the committee. I am Donald Drain. I am a hearing aid dealer in Portland, Oregon, and I am the president of the Oregon Hearing Aid Society. I would like to state that we are in opposition to the Bill 2165 as it was amended yesterday. We do support, of course, the amendments offered by Mr. Reinhardt this morning. I would like to just make a couple of comments. We have spoken of education and experience, Beeler is the pragmatist when it comes to hearing aid evaluation and working with clients with amplification. I would like to comment one important area, and that is that the layperson generally has the feeling from much testimony that we've heard that a hearing aid might be prescribed, or you know, stated in exact terms, as perhaps eyeglasses or other types of prosthesis. And I believe there's ample evidence that this is not possible. And I would like to quote from J. Donald Harris, PhD, chief behavioral scientist, U.S. Naval Submarine Medical Research Laboratory. Dr. Harris has authored numerous papers and texts in many fields, including the following. In an article called Hearing Aid Prescription, Fact or Fantasy, he states the thrust of this note is to point out that it is a chimera for the public to be led to feel there is a better system awaiting in the wings, that there is a body of professionals who only await the words to start writing an accurate prescription for each hypothesis, and that these slips of paper will solve a whole class of problems. In the public mind, the word prescription certainly implies a precision by analogy with a carefully compounded drug mixture or specially ground eyeglasses to which the hearing health professions have not yet attained. The word is to that extent a misnomer. A prescription implies that the prescriber has, number one, a quantitative evaluation of the patient's problem, and two, a detailed picture of the prosthesis known to best alleviate that problem or problems. Today, we usually have neither. Another brief comment from Robert Christie, a prominent nationally famous audiologist, non-medical, who states, we could arrive at prescription accuracy with conscientious effort through the joint cooperation of many disciplines in the field of hearing if we could step away from the current measurement technique. Christie predicts it will come in the next 10 years after the current polarization of ideas has been set aside in favor of communication. We may approach the prescription accuracy after we've determined, one, which dimensions of hearing aid performance are critical for which type of loss, two, how best to select a hearing aid for a hearing impaired individual, and three, development of new and realistic tests. These tasks we have not yet accomplished. I would just briefly go from that. In our research of programs that we have offered the legislature this session, we asked Glenn Peck, who is the supervisor of the conservation of hearing program for the Triple Children's Services in the state of Washington, to give us some ideas, and he did address the Committee on Aging. And I would like to point out particularly one area supporting much of what you heard today also. State law requires an otological and audiological evaluation for all persons under age 18. This is justified on the basis that most medical, surgical, correctable hearing losses occur within the age group, and we, of course, should support that to the child. I will go through this briefly. Point five, I think, is particularly important here because of the fact that we deal mostly with the elderly. And it is stated in point five, it was determined that most elderly persons, when this state started their program to aid the indigent elderly in the state of Washington, most elderly persons had already consulted several physicians and had been told that nothing could be done by medical or surgical means to improve their hearing. Or if they were among the approximately 2% who had a hearing loss correctable by surgical means, physicians were generally hesitant to do surgery. He firmly supports audiology and otological pathology professionals. I would briefly comment, if I may, on two points that were made earlier today. I was just back to Washington, D.C., and in talking to a president of one of the other state societies, he asked me about House Bill 2165 in its original form. And it seems that it came into his possession a letter from the Colorado State University at Fort Collins, Colorado, with an attachment of House Bill 2165. The contents of the letter, if I may, are as follows.
Sure, we're due on the floor of the Senate at 10 o'clock, if you could make it as brief as possible.
I do, thank you, Chairman. I only wanted to point out that these audiologists in the hearing clinic there apparently are interested in the sense of hearing, which we have no argument with as long as it is done with due choice to the consumer. I also wish to point out that in the section dealing with the bill at hand, as respects the opinion of a contract by an audiologist, I would like only to make the point that it is very difficult to determine exactly what is determined, as I pointed out in my earlier testimony here. And we have tried to make our amendments to the bill to speak very much as Carol Mitchell just mentioned, too, as respects to medical health. We do recognize the problems in this state and geography and transportation.
Question. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Miller?
You're kind of up. Do you have time for a comment?
Yes.
Mr. Neal?
I'm William J. Miller. I am speaking for myself, although I am president of the Retired Educators Association of Oregon.
and have been a member since 1971 of the Joint Legislative Committee between the AARP and NRCA. Neither of those organizations am I speaking for, simply saying to you that I do represent a great group of people who are consumers, and we are terribly concerned about the consumers. We wish not to get into the argument between the two groups that are presenting themselves here this morning, except to say that we are still the consumers and we do need your help. We come simply to say that as consumers, we see no reason why, if I should be the person in the receptive place, that I would like the person who is trying to present me with an instrument to improve my health and my well-being, that he would submit himself wholeheartedly to the spirit of 2165. I think that there's nothing in there that would interfere with his doing a tremendously good job. I think there's nothing in there that would keep him from rendering service to me. And I simply want to say that while all of the argument goes on as between them, we the consumers are still sitting out here in a mood of waiting and watching and hoping that, as the lady said a while ago, the little bit that we live on is fading pretty fast. And we'd like very much to get within the keeping of that. I think 2165 is possibly a good deal. I don't understand the technicalities that have been presented from both sides here. God knows, I hope that each of you do. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Questions? That concludes the hearing on 2165. We'll turn to 2070. Mr. Bailey.
Professor Henry J. Bailey, I'm a professor of law at Willamette University here in Salem. I'm here to speak in favor of 2070, which substitutes a system of central filing under Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code in place of the present system of what is generally local and, in many instances, both local and central filing. This would substitute central filing in all instances except where the collateral in a secured transaction consists of fixtures or oil, gas, and minerals. Products of that type. Otherwise, there would be central filing. This bill has been recommended by the state bar, and as a professor of law, I go along with the recommendation. Essentially, what we do here is to change from the Uniform Commercial Code Draftsman Alternative C, which provides for the present local and, to some extent, central filing, to the Draftsman Alternative A, which provides for central filing in all instances except in with respect to fixtures and that type of product. The real reason for recommending central filing is that there's been a lot of confusion with the present system, both here in Oregon and to a great extent this can be shown in cases from other states. As a speaker who teaches Article 9 in my law school, I have occasion to look at virtually all of the Article 9 decisions that come down in the report. And I would say that a good 25% of the Article 9 decisions have involved problems of filing, problems of making filing errors. And many of those have involved some error in filing where this dual filing in both the central and the local office, has been required. And if we were to go to central filing, I think many of these problems would be eliminated. This is not a creditor's bill. This is not oriented toward any concept except to improve the law, to improve the regularization of commercial transactions. And it does not really benefit creditors except that it makes their job a little bit easier and would save some secure transactions from going sour as they now do.
Okay. Thank you very much. For those persons in the room, there's not going to be any further action on any bill this morning. The primary reason being we don't have a quorum. Senator Roberts.
What happened on the bill the other day that appeared in the Ag Committee and opposed the filing with the Department of Agriculture?
That has resulted in, pardon me, I want to get to the number of that bill, 3143. That resulted in a group of us meeting with Representative Magruder and others, and that bill has been amended so that we are going to substitute filing with the Secretary of State in place of filing with the Department of Agriculture.
Okay, we'll be consistent with this
bill.
And
it would be consistent with this, and Representative Magruder, as I understand it, is behind both this bill and 3143.
Right, now just to clarify, you're going to require all filings in Secretary of State's office?
All filings except for fixtures, minerals, oil, gas, that type of product.
In addition to local filing?
No, only in the Secretary of State.
We're going to
take away all local filing. This will eliminate local filing except for fixtures and that type of product.
Does that create a problem for people who may have some difficulty communicating with the Secretary of State's office on getting the information? The hinterlands for...
For one thing, there's going to be direct telephone communication with the Secretary of State's office. That is contemplated if the Secretary of State takes this over. At the present time, some collateral has to be filed both locally and with the Secretary of State's office. And when that is done, as I understand it, I've heard of no problems with communication. Incidentally, Senator, the state of California has essentially sent a filing of this type, and I heard of no problems with communication there. They incidentally went into central filing after a very unsatisfactory court decision came down in the Ninth Circuit involving a piece of funds with them.
Well, it makes sense. You can find out where it's filed from any part of the state.
You can find out where it's filed from any part of the state by letter, by phone inquiry. And in the case of organizations that are regularly in the business of lending, they can, of course, have someone here in Salem who can check personally. Also, in any publication that's a publisher filing, the finding of what has been filed would be much simpler if we only have one office to look at.
It would make a good local government bill, too, if we relieve them of a little expense.
It would relieve them of some expense, and Senator Duma, I had the experience last fall of addressing a meeting of the county clerk out in Lakeview, and when I told them of some of the problems that they could run into with mishandling a filing, I saw some, shall we say, very unhappy looking faces in the room.
Thank you, sir. John Boyd.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Don Boyd. I'm a lawyer with the United States National Bank. Professor Bailey has outlined the bill and its effects, and I don't think I'll try to duplicate that except to say that we support the bill because we think it's a piece of progressive legislation to simplify not only our job, but the job of other creditors, many of whom are not so deeply involved in secured transactions. By simplifying the system, it would eliminate a lot of confusion and a lot of mistakes. And maybe just as important, it would also eliminate dual filing, which is an additional cost to the borrower. As you know, it's almost a universal practice to charge filing fees directly to the borrower around the country. And this would mean that in the business collateral case where dual filing is typically required, there would only have to be one financial statement filed and paid for by the borrower instead of two. But I think the most important thing is simplification and the elimination of confusion. Just to respond directly to Senator Roberts' inquiry, I think in theory, local filing may often be helpful, but in reality, it often causes more problems than the convenience would justify. For example, in many cases, for example, in Eastern Oregon, farmers may have collateral livestock or crops growing in different counties of the state, and there, multiple filings are required in multiple districts. Frequently, a creditor will not realize that the farmer has collateral in different counties and will file a local search in the wrong county, so be it where.
Thank you very much, sir. Mr. McGinnis?
My name is Chuck McGinnis. I'm a lawyer. I work for First National Bank of Oregon. I'm here at the time. I support everything that Professor Bailey and John Boyd have said. I'd be happy to answer your question.
Thank you very much. Mr. Collins?
I just want to support everything that the gentleman has said, except for the fact that from the standpoint of one who deals extensively in uniform commercial code in this state, and in several states around the country, I can certainly tell you that this would be a tremendous improvement. And being that I'm a member of the Oregon Association of Credit Management, an organization that represents some 750 wholesalers, manufacturers, and banks, I'm on the legislative committee, They are heartily in support of this because it's certainly going to simplify things for everyone concerned.
Did you attend the House?
Yes, I did.
Was there any opposition?
There were 4 dissenting votes on the bill that passed this particular bill in the House on Monday. 4 dissenting votes. So we feel very good about that.
Did anybody in here, do you know, in the committee against the
bill? I believe Representative Mark was the only dissenting vote in the House Judiciary Committee.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Thank you.